24 hours from Tulsa. Only a day away from your arms. I saw a welcoming light and stopped to rest for the night. And that is when I saw her as I pulled in outside of the small hotel. She was there, and so I walked up to her, asked where I could get something to eat, and she showed me where. Oh, I was only 24 hours from Tulsa, only one day away from your arms. She took me to the cafe. I asked her if she would stay. She said, only 24 hours from Tulsa, only one day away from your arms. The jukebox started to play, and nighttime turned into day. As we were dancing closely, all of a sudden I lost control as I held her charms, and I caressed her, kissed her, told her I'd die before I would let her out of my arms. Oh, I was only 24 hours from Tulsa, only one day away from your arms. I hate to do this to you, for I love somebody new. What can I do when I can never, never, never go home again?
And so we reach what we can refer to, as far as Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio is concerned, as the Water Hour, because we'll be focusing very much on World Water Day and the notion of taking water for granted. We already heard earlier this week that nationally, although we're an island, we might still have challenges with respect to reservoirs and various other things, but even more tragically, and I do use the term quite deliberately, when you've got a situation where 844 million people globally are without access to clean water, that is unacceptable. Acceptable for any from any perspective, and so to address some of the issues relating to this, we're delighted to welcome from the wonderful world of the One Foundation, Victoria Stewart Todd. Good morning, Victoria.
Morning.
And indeed, trading director for the co-op, that would be CJ Antle Smith. How are you, CJ? Victoria. Shocking almost seems an understatement when you look at these sort of things. 844 million people living without access to safe water across the world. 3.4 million deaths contributing to waterborne diseases, or contributed by waterborne diseases each year. It's not a good state of affairs.
No, it's a very serious, serious challenge. I mean, 844 million people is about one in nine. So one in nine people in the world don't have a safe water supply, and one in three people don't have access to a safe toilet. And that's really one of the major factors in the high statistics on waterborne diseases.
And some of those diseases, obviously, are things that we kind of might have thought we'd eradicated or we'd never actually had. Our Victorian predecessors realised that actually sewage and getting effective sewage systems was essential to preventing cholera and aspects like that. You know, surely it doesn't take much to say, look, these are fundamentals that all human beings have a right to.
Well, the human right to water and sanitation is recognised by the UN. It's definitely a human rights issue. And not only is it a human right in and of itself, but the UN recognises that access to water and sanitation is really crucial to enabling people to enjoy all their human rights, so the right to life or dignity or education. It's all really interlinked, so it's so important that we find sustainable solutions to the problem.
Partnerships are obviously very important, and they do actually help. And if we can turn to the Deputy Director, or rather CJ Antle Smith, the Trading Director of Ambient the British Water System of the Co-op. Is that BWS, or have I got the acronym wrong there?
Yes, no, that's correct.
Okay. CJ, from your own perspective, what are we kind of seeing some progress in this particular field? Is there a way in which we need to acknowledge that, you know, we can address this, or is it just a case of it's too big a problem for little me to sort out?
No, I mean, I think we're really proud that we're talking today about the £10 million that the Co-op have raised to help the One Foundation to address some of these issues. And we work really well with a lot of our partners, not just the One Foundation, but we've also worked very closely with Stella Artois, with the Pour It Forward campaign, with Water.org, and also a beer company called Brewgooder. So they have a well-dig campaign, and 100% of their profits from co-op sales of their four-pack lager help fund clean water projects in Malawi, which is obviously helping the problem. As you said earlier, that, you know, there's still a scalable problem with 844 million people without access to clean water, but it's not something that can be fixed overnight. It's something that needs longevity and a good plan behind it. The sale of our water and this £10 million is really, really important to helping to start to address that problem.
In the studio, we've got young journalist Jack Cochrane. Jack, you've had a chance to read this story. You've looked at some of the facts. I mean, in Nairobi, you've got people, families paying illegally high prices for water from unlicensed traders. What were your thoughts?
I mean, I think in this day and age, it's completely wrong that there are still people going without clean water. I mean, when you look at all the sort of projects that are in place and things that are trying to help people gain the access to clean water, I mean, to still be without it is... it's completely baffling, really.
So let's talk about the One Foundation and the way in which this is partnering up with respect to the Co-op. Victoria, the steps that you're actually taking to begin to address this, would you like to just outline them?
Sure. So we're focused at the moment on four countries in particular: Ghana, Rwanda, Kenya and Malawi. And we work with local partners there to build clean water and sanitation services that are really sustainable for the communities we work in. So about 70% of our work is in urban communities. So if you imagine kind of the informal settlements in Nairobi, that kind of environment, which is really challenging. And also we work in rural communities for about 20% of the time in Malawi, which is a very different context. We're working in, for example, tea-growing regions where people are sharing a community water source between them that may or may not be safe and that may need repairing. So we're working across all those different challenges to try and find sustainable solutions.
We started off that piece by talking about how taking showers as opposed to taking baths is much more important, not letting your taps keep running when brushing your teeth and so on. Beyond those kind of areas, is there a sense that we're getting more aware in Britain that actually, although we appear to be very wealthy when it comes to water resources, we still need to ensure that as far as water consumption is concerned, we are mindful of the fact that it's a precious resource?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, obviously, we take it for granted. We all have taps in our home. We have access to bottled water in stores. I think that we could say that we take it for granted. But I think what's important on days like today, World Water Day, is raising that awareness and really understanding it. One of the things that we've been doing is rolling out free water taps in stores, and we've got our first stores in Manchester and Leeds, and we try to encourage our consumers to come and fill up their water bottles there, and they can choose or not to make a small donation for doing that, which will go towards clean sanitation projects. I think Victoria's done some great work on One Foundation in terms of the 5-litre challenge Victoria was telling me earlier.
Yeah, that's a really great way to kind of really raise awareness about water poverty. So we challenge people to live on 5 litres of water for 24 hours and to get their friends and family to sponsor them. And that really gets you thinking about how you're going to use your 5 litres, how you're going to ration that out. You know, you can't have a shower, for example. You've got to really think about what you're going to cook and have you got enough water to drink. So that's a really simple way for people to really start understanding what people are going through.
Well, I tell you what, let's throw that little challenge to Jack. I mean, I'm sure with your students at the University of Staffordshire, that might be a way forward. Would you be up for taking that challenge?
Yeah, definitely be up for looking into it.
How could Jack actually sort of find out how to do this and maybe get some of the other students involved at the University of Staffordshire? I'll spread the word to the University of Lincoln, we'll get the University of Teesside involved. How can we roll this out?
You can go onto our website, onedifference.org/donate, if you want to make a direct contribution. But there's also more information there on how you can fundraise for us, including doing the 5-litre challenge. So we'd advise that you go on the website and find out some more information and then just get signed up.
So I'm thinking 5 litres, that's kind of like 5 average-sized bottles. And you're looking to basically just use that for 24 hours, 48 hours? What's the line?
We challenge you for 24 hours.
I mean,
if you want to go for 48, you can try, but your colleagues and your family and friends might not appreciate
this
it.
This is true. That is true, exactly. I mean, after all, we need to sort of work our way through that process. Is the prognosis good? I mean, you know, because one tends to think that back in the day, obviously 30 years ago, Live Aid, and that was a different thing, that was famine and so on, but are we seeing progress with respect to projects like this, and or is it, I hesitate to use the term, a drop in the ocean?
We are seeing progress. The statistics have reduced over time, so we are seeing progress, but as CJ said, it's not an overnight solution, and I think what we've learned along the way is that quick fix, cheap solutions just don't work. So the One Foundation is totally focused on sustainable solutions, and that does take time, but it means that communities don't then become dependent on aid. They've got a reliable, safely managed clean water supply, so that when charities step back, we know that that water supply is going to be delivering water for them for generations to come.
Jack, do you have any final questions or thoughts you want to put to either CJ or indeed Victoria?
No, that's really interesting. I mean, finding out all that sort of the points of view and the way you have to sort of look at it. And I mean, that 5-litre challenge is definitely something that I'll be looking into, sort of putting to some of my colleagues at Staffordshire University. So, thank you for that.
And, I mean, obviously, it's 2 days ago, it was a World Happiness Day. You can't be happy if you don't have water. We're now on World Water Day. We need to be mindful, certainly, of these kind of areas. Can we have a reminder, please, Victoria, of the best websites to actually go to for further information?
It's onedifference.org, or if you want to go to the Co-op's website.
Yeah, the Co-op website's got a blog on there for World Water Day, and it'll just talk to you about our journey and the kind of things that we're doing in conjunction with the One Foundation to help to lead on this problem.
Well, I'm thinking as the fine folk at the Co-op, actually one of the key supporters of Siren Radio in its early days and incarnations, we must work together as well. So as well as Manchester, so we should incorporate Lincoln too. So we'll work on that basis. Victoria Stewart Todd and CJ Antle Smith, many thanks indeed. Take care, and hopefully we'll speak again soon with better news.
Thank you.
Sunset, I am in paradise.
don't insult your music intelligence by saying it was Ray Davis and his Kinks, Waterloo Sunset. Coming up, we will hopefully be speaking to Sarah Thornton, weather specialist, and indeed the hurricane man himself, Josh Morgerman. That'll be talking about extreme weather. Do you feel that the weather is getting more extreme, Jack?
I mean, you know, when you look at it, the way the summers have been going, and I mean, even the winter, or sort of February, the hottest February on record for some conceivable time, it's definitely changing from what I used to remember. But
well, we'll find out what Sarah and Josh actually have to do about this. 3 in 5 British folk apparently think we'll see much more extreme weather in the near future. And again, is the question being asked, is there anything we can actually do to stop this extreme weather, which clearly could have... I'm not sure. I think... Yeah, gusts of wind, that can be very, very, very sort of challenging in more ways than one, really. Indeed. But anyway, have faith. We'll see you through it. Southside Broadcasting, Channel 1 for Hospedia. And more Book of the Month, of course, coming up as well. Curiously, of course, on World Water Day, talking about the shape of water. We'll make sure Jenny's aware of that. And, of course, we're going to the Platform A Gallery in Middlesbrough to find out what exciting exhibition they've got coming up in the very near future. That's if there's time. Now, being British, clearly one of the things we speak about when there's nothing else to say is, turned out nice again, hasn't it? Or, isn't it awful? Isn't it dreadful? Isn't it changing? We've just done it in the studio, haven't we, Jack? We've just been talking about the weather. And it's World Water Day, so what best can we actually talk about? Last year, the beast from the east, of course. This year, the warmest February since records began. Fairly extreme by anybody's statement. So why not actually bring in two fantastic experts to address this? First of all, weather expert extraordinaire. She's the finest presenter you could ever wish to actually have from the Met Office. It's Sarah Thornton. How are you, Sarah?
Morning to you. Thanks very much indeed for that. I'll pay you later.
Oh, that's perfectly good. And then a man who is a genuine superhero. He is Hurricane Man. He's Josh Morgerman. How are you, Josh?
Howdy. Nice to meet you.
Excellent. Josh, can we come to you? Because obviously, I know we actually have heard of mini tornadoes and hurricanes sometimes emerging in Britain, but thankfully, unlike Kansas, where I get the feeling we're no longer there anymore, Toto, we don't have too many difficulties here. Or is that going to be changing?
Well, I don't think you guys are going to be getting bona fide hurricanes anytime soon. You know, the thing that hurricanes need, the source of fuel is warm water. So actually, hurricanes approach the UK all the time, but the water around it is so cold that they kind of unravel and they just sort of become these messy storm systems by the time they get there. Now, actually, last year, Hurricane Ophelia it was a hurricane up until about 12 hours before it came ashore in Ireland, and you know, it structurally was no longer a hurricane, but that's just technical stuff that normal people don't care about. The point is, it came ashore in Ireland with hurricane force winds, and I know people who experienced that are in the southern part of the United Kingdom. It was crazy.
We have a regular monthly show with John Ketley, a weather person, obviously you may have heard of, who still actually refers back to the Michael Fish Great Storm of 1987 scenario. Sarah, you would not have made that mistake if we went to weathertrending.com. That would never have happened. I know it wouldn't, Sarah. So.
Well, you know, I know John and I know Michael very well, have worked with them in the past, and everyone is doing their best. And the thing about the Michael Fish story is it's in some ways slightly apocryphal. First of all, he said, of course, famously, Mrs. Biggins or whatever has rung the BBC and said she hears there's a hurricane on the way, but there isn't, don't worry. I mean, in many ways, he was right. The 87 storm wasn't a hurricane for a start, but, you know, it was this very deep area of low pressure. He, of course, did his broadcast early evening, and it was as the evening wore on that they were quite a little bit clearer about where it was coming. It was more really likely to go to France, actually, initially, and, of course, it did really affect parts of northern France and the Low Countries, but it also came a little bit further north into parts of southern England, particularly, and into Essex and that kind of area. So he was sort of right and he was wrong at the same time, but he's made a great career out of it, so he doesn't hate it, I'll tell you that right now.
Indeed so. Now, Sarah, if we're looking at the Hurricane Man, as you are at the studio, because he's opposite the microphone, sorry, I couldn't resist that, but what exactly can we expect to see in the fantastic UK TV series Hurricane Man?
Well, I'll tell you, as a weather enthusiast, because I like to think of myself in that way, even though it is my actual profession, I'm just a lover of extreme weather. It is the best hour of TV I've seen for many, many a year. I've seen episode one, in which Josh is in the center of Hurricane Michael last October, and it is heart-pounding, palm-sweating sort of stuff, really. I really just couldn't look at it, the screen, a couple of times. I was sort of like, get out of it. But it is amazing because you really see just how intense these storms are. I mean, you brought up the 1987 storm, and the winds that are in the hurricane that Josh is in Hurricane Michael, are so much stronger than the storm winds that we saw in the 1987 storm. The peak gust we saw in the UK in 1987 was 120 miles an hour, maximum sustained winds of 80 miles an hour. Hurricane Michael, well, it would laugh at that. 155 mile an hour sustained winds is what that had. And Josh is right there in it, and you see him. And at one point, I thought, he's gone. He's gone. I knew there were more episodes in the series, so that was the only thing that kept me hanging on to the fact that he was still with us.
Cliffhanger ending, contractual details, who knows what could have happened. Josh, we're coming to you because, I mean, I've got to say, I share Sarah's concern with respect to this. I mean, in the studio we have Jack Cockrum. I mean, Jack, have you ever considered, when you graduate from the University of Staffordshire, going in as a hurricane chaser?
I can't say it's something I've thought about, but it's definitely an interesting career path.
Well, interesting. Jenny Finch, ace writer, would you consider chasing hurricanes as a career?
No, I lived through the 1987 hurricane. It ripped my roof off.
There we are. So you see,
not again.
Exactly. And I bet, Jenny, it's fair to say, we're just talking about Michael Fish, you would have obviously sort of been not happy with the man.
Just a little peeved.
There, you see, that's it, Sarah. The public never quite forget on that basis. But let's turn back to Josh, really, because, again, what was it that, I mean, when you were at school, did you say to your tutors, etc., yeah, actually, I want to be a hurricane chaser?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's sort of like a mental disorder, I think, that I was born with. So I grew up on an island off the east coast of the U.S., and we would occasionally get a hurricane. And even as a toddler, you know, when I'd see the wind start to blow, the house would shake, trees would start swaying. I just got this reaction. It was like drugs. I'd get excited by it. And my whole life has been just kind of hunting down that feeling again and again. You know, the first chase I did, I was too young to drive, so I actually just got on a train and chased the hurricane up the east coast of the U.S. I can't believe I did that. It was before the Internet or anything. So, yeah, my whole life has been doing that, and it wasn't even, I didn't even know that there was a name for what that was. I didn't know that there was such a thing as storm chasing. I just was doing it. And, you know, but, yeah, my whole life has just been kind of going further and further from home into, you know, more and more violent storms, trying to kind of recapture that feeling. The big change in how I'm doing things now, and the thing I get really excited about, is collecting data. You know, a lot of these hurricanes and typhoons, they come ashore in really remote areas. There might not be weather stations. So the data I collect from the centers of these storms coming ashore in the middle of, you know, maybe parts of the Philippines or Mexico where there aren't weather stations, is data that helps scientists really understand, okay, what happened on the ground. And that's really cool. It's kind of like bringing the missing puzzle piece to the scientific analysis of what happened in these events.
There are a whole range of theories and conceptions about whether it's a case of a metaphysical point of view, somehow a reflection of the political ideologies of the time, so lots of hurricanes when Brexit's occurring, obviously, don't go there, it's a different line, or whether it's a case of it's a strange paranormal experience. I've spoken to paranormal professors over in Los Angeles who say, yes, this is all the Bermuda Triangle, etc. I mean, is it all down to weather systems and lines from that point of view, and the turbulence and the chaos that we actually exist in? That's the planet Earth.
I think it's interesting, you know, like, I've been in many hurricanes, I think more than any living person, or probably any person, period, and even to me, when I'm in a really violent hurricane like Michael, it's so violent and loud and crazy and otherworldly that I forget that this is just a natural earth process. The earth is a violent place, and I don't mean the people, I mean the earth, you know, earthquakes, tsunamis, hurricanes. The earth is incredibly violent. We get in the way of these processes, and it feels crazy on the ground. And I can understand why ancient peoples, when a hurricane would strike or something like that, that they would feel like it was the God's wrath. Because even to me, knowing the science behind it, knowing it's just a natural occurrence, even to me, when I'm in a really bad hurricane, it feels angry. It's the only way I could describe it. It's just this rage. It's incredible.
And from a person's point of view, my parents actually live in Florida, so this is all very, very close to my heart, although the difference between me and John is that I run away from a hurricane and convince everyone else to run away as well, whereas he runs straight into them. But my parents, they lived in Pennsylvania where you had some severe snow every single year, and my father rang up and he said, no more with this weather, we're moving to Florida. And then wouldn't you know it, they had 4 storms the year that he moved there. And, you know, he's a big guy, my dad, he's a brave guy, he's young. And he said, I've never been as terrified in all my life. And they weren't even seeing some severe storms because they live in Central Florida. By the time they get across the land there, they tend to have really sort of dissipated or certainly lost a lot of intensity. And he's been in a couple of Cat 1 storms and that kind of thing. He says they're terrifying. You look at Josh Moggeman across the table from me. He's running to these Cat 4 storms. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, Josh, no spoilers, but I mean, sorry, I did say she thought she'd gone at the end of episode 3, episode 4, etc. So, I mean, in terms of that, where can people actually look to find the Hurricane Man? Is it UK TV or will it be on various other channels as well?
Yes, so folks can catch it very soon. It premieres, the premiere of this action-packed episode 1 is 7 p.m. this Sunday on Dave. And here's the cool thing. So episode 1 is, it ends with a cliffhanger. I mean, it's like, it's pretty intense stuff. If you really want to see what happened, you can immediately get episode 2 or rewatch episode 1 on UK TV Play immediately. So that's pretty cool. So you can get that immediate gratification if you want to just make sure that I'm still here. And I'm not just a spirit from the...
I mean, I can't wait to see what happens in episode 2 because actually the really clever thing about this show is it's about Josh and he's the expert, but there are also some people with him in terms of the camera crew, the documentary crew, who are not experts in this field, and it's the first time they've ever lived through anything like this. And seeing the look on their faces compared to the look on Josh's face.
Sarah, 3 words, health and safety. I mean, surely, you know.
That's the one thing I thought about. And one of the things that was going through my head is, what happened when they rented these cars with the car insurance? All those sorts of questions went through my head.
And that, Sarah, is why you are the goddess of weather predictions, you see. That's the critical thing about it. Jenny, any thoughts or questions for yourself? I mean, I can see a book coming out of this, certainly from your own life.
I think somebody has to chase them to make sure they go away, but it wouldn't be me.
That's the whole point. I mean, that sums up the whole thing. Josh is actually saying, go away now, I'm after you. Yeah. In fact, actually, that might be the point, Josh. Maybe the hurricane's more scared of yourself and the storm chasers than actually... Just a thought. It's a whole range of things there. Best place to go to find out further details, I mean, apart from, obviously, the joys of weathertrending.com.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. And also, you're on Twitter, aren't you, Josh?
Yeah, you can follow me in my adventures and get updates on the show at iCyclone on Twitter or Facebook. That's the letter I, the word cyclone, iCyclone.
Fantastic. Sarah Thornton, ace weather expert, and indeed Josh Morgerman, the Hurricane Man. I take it you've had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning and not too windy or breezy.
No, we've enjoyed it. Not too many showers. It is turbulent times, as you say, but this has been a calming oasis.
I think so. Theresa May, take note, please. I take it then we can return and speak with you again soon?
Yes, take care. Thanks very much.
Yay. Thank you so much.
So it is World Water Day, and we have welcomed Jenny Finch to the studio. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning.
And, of course, we still have the wonderful Jack Cochrane. And, Jack, we've moved from water conservation to chasing hurricanes, chasing storms. In that oasis of calm, we're now onto Middlesbrough train station. We're looking at Platform 8 Gallery, and we're delighted to speak to the director of Platform 8 Gallery. That's Tony Charles. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
Excellent. Now, Tony, before we go into this awesome exhibition, which launches on the 28th of March and highlights work from Bobby Benjamin, Connor Shields, Craig Oldham, Faye Hadfield, Anna Hannah Leighton Boyce, Helen Paling, Craig Wilson, Mary Griffith, Nicola Ellis, and Northern industrial painter Theodore Major, Jenny has a slight challenge with respect to, because Jenny, you use the trains, you've seen Platform and Gallery, sometimes you haven't been able to get in.
I haven't ever been able to get into it.
So, you know, Tony.
Well, I'll tell you, the reason for that is probably either because we're in between exhibitions, or a lot of people, many people don't read the door and it says ring the doorbell.
Oh.
I went backwards and forwards between two doors, front and back, couldn't get in.
Nope.
And a friend of mine, this was when they were doing a lot of the changes and the rebuilding, but a friend of mine with disabilities couldn't get anywhere near it at that point. So I hope you're now disable access.
Well, the construction at the front of the gallery is now completed and it's reopened. So it's more, we're in more, in view a lot more now.
Good.
In which case, and I tell you what, Tony, I'll physically bring Jenny along so we can actually sort of we'll march into the hall and we'll press the doorbell.
And ring the doorbell, yes, please.
Or we'll get somebody there. I mean, Jack will be around for that. Now, if we do that, if we go along from March the 28th, March 28th is the preview, and tragedy.
That's the preview.
That's the preview.
6 till 8 on the evening.
And tragedy, I appreciate the invite, but I may be in Lincoln at that particular time. But when it actually continues, the actual sort of event itself, talk to us about the industrial narrative and major conversations.
Well, there's I'm working on this project with a curator called Mark Parham, and Mark is quite passionate about art and is quite passionate about the north of England, and he has along with me have chosen a number of artists who not necessarily have overtly industrial concerns in their art, but maybe that because they're from this region, a sense of place is embedded within their practice, if that makes sense. So, for instance, we'll have Faye Hadfield, who she now works in Bath, but she's from the northeast. She uses a lot of ceramics in her installations, and she sees her kiln as representing the blast furnace on Teesside. So there's a lot of subtle references to the region. And we also have a concern with what is heritage in terms of art. So we're using late 19th century painter called Theodore Major, who paints these industrial dystopias, if you like. And it's very much considered as heritage art. It's kind of quite traditional, even though some of the images are quite haunting. And we are placing Theodore Major alongside contemporary artworks just to set up a conversation about what actually heritage is, if that makes sense.
It does indeed. In fact, it makes so much sense. We've just been joined in the studio by Rob Nichols. Rob, we are speaking to Tony, of course, the main man behind the Platform A Gallery. And I hope, actually, Rob, you will be able to avail yourself. I mean, I know so many good things actually happening with respect to Radio 1, Big Weekend, and other sort of happenings that are coming in Middlesbrough. We won't talk about Aston Villa's result. But in terms of Tony Charles, Platform A Gallery, this fantastic thing, Major Conversations, / The Industrial Narrative, I think you could represent us on March 28th, Rob. I'm forwarding it. I'm doing this, Tony, without any discussion whatsoever. I'm just throwing. I'm throwing in Rob Nichols into
this. I'm looking forward to attending. Yes, I really enjoyed the last exhibition there. It was a really brilliant idea to bring all these thoughts about birdsong together, and to get people in the middle of a town thinking about the dawn chorus. They could still hear it in the middle of a town, and the fact that it came from all different angles. And this one, similarly, it's going to be like an investigation, isn't it, in a way, about the buildings, architecture, encourage people to look around them. And such a fantastic setting, the gallery. It's it's passed by thousands of people every day, so hopefully a lot of these people will pass in.
Jenny was one of them, as we found out, you know, door to door. Only she'd ring the bell. I'm looking at the website, actually, at present, Tony, platformagallery.net, founded as an extension to Platform Art Studios in 2011, of course. Platform A is a gallery dedicated to innovative developments in contemporary art through its diverse programme of exhibitions. Located in the railway station of Central Middlesbrough, Platform A represents emerging and established artists and is committed to working creatively, exploring new approaches to arrive at the best outcomes to provide the highest calibre exhibition programme. So, it's really great, actually, that we're putting, again, Middlesbrough on the map and making great use of space. I mean, and Tony, is it something which, is it a labour of love? Is it a case of you wake up on a morning and think, it can't get much better than this?
Well, actually, it's to do with how much talent there is in the region and not enough galleries that can show them, that show this talent. That's not to say that we only show artists from the regions, of course. We're outward looking. We bring artists from other parts of the country and abroad, which makes the gallery all the more prestigious for local artists to be able to exhibit in when they actually do.
Jenny, have you got any questions you want to put to Tony about exhibitions and so on, and how this is another great leap forward for the region that Middlesbrough is?
Yes. How long does the exhibition last for?
It lasts until the 9th of May, this particular exhibition.
So there's a good window of opportunity for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, 6 weeks every show.
Certainly, I mean, Rob has already raised my guilt level factors for not being able to actually attend the Birdsong exhibition, so I'm going to definitely be there for the 9th of May.
Well, Tony, we've programmed an event right at the end of the exhibition in Local History Month, a talk near the end, so that gives people an opportunity to come and it gets a bit of advertising within the local history sort of fraternity, because people who are into history will be into this exhibition, I think, won't they?
Yeah, fantastic. We also have an event programmed, which is a symposium. Because this exhibition is called Major Conversations, we want to have conversations, and so we're going to have a symposium to talk about the show and to talk about the issues that it might throw up.
Brilliant.
Sounds good. Our ambassador from the University of Staffordshire, although he started off at Teesside, but let's not talk about that. From your own perspective, Jack, is this something which appealed to your good self when you were sort of around, fancy doing a location report here?
I mean, I'll be back from university about a week after the exhibition starts, so I'd definitely be interested to
get you down,
we'll get that sorted.
We will come there and do a whole variety of other bits and pieces there. And a reminder, of course, platformagallery.net is the go-to website for it. This might be an impossible question to actually answer, Tony, but of all the artists we mentioned, Bobby Benjamin, Connie Shields, etc., is there one that stands out that you think, that was a good one, or is it a case of, I can't choose that, that'd be a nightmare to pay?
Yeah, I know, I can't really... What I would say is that the kind of spanner in the works, if you like, is Theodore Major, because it's not seen as contemporary art, and that's the interesting conversation that is being set up.
I love the way you use spanner in the works there. Industrial narrative, spanner in the works. Yeah. Jeez, yes, it's fantastic. Rob, any final questions you'd like to add?
Look forward to seeing you next week, Tony.
Yeah, and you, Rob.
It's going to be great. So you are going to be representing us.
And
fantastic. That's a sigh of relief for you, basically. Because, I mean, how I could ever respond to Michaela Wetherill, Ace Curating and Marketing Manager for the Platform A Gallery, I just don't know, basically. Tony, it's been fantastic. Take care. See you very soon.
Thank you.